Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hello and welcome to the Runner's World podcast with me, Rick Pearson. Today we're discussing 10 marathon mistakes and how not to make them in the company of Andy Dixon and Kate Carter. Welcome back to the Runner's World podcast.
Hello.
Hi.
It's one of those things I said with a guest, you had to be a sub-3 marathoner to come on here. So I thought, who could I ask? It's Andy and Kate, isn't it?
The sub-3 club.
But yeah, we were thinking of like podcast ideas that listeners would be interested in terms of like... You know, what people are searching for. And obviously the marathon is still the marquee event, I'd say, in our sport. And it is an event that's easy to get wrong, I would say. I think we've probably all been there. I don't think... Do you feel like you've ever run your perfect marathon, Kate?
I don't know. I think in retrospect, you think you have, because yeah. I think time, you know, blunts the hard edges, yeah. And you forget the moments that weren't so great, and you think, oh yeah, that was my PB, it must have been great. But no, I don't think so. I'm sure that you've always got a bit more you could learn or give.
Yeah, I think so. What about you, Andy? When you ran sub-3, was that the perfect race, do you think, or not?
No, it wasn't, because I had to stop a couple of times, yeah. In the second half, because I was getting hamstring cramp. So obviously a perfect race would have been a kind of straight through. I would have sailed through those last miles. But I mean, it's one of my points, actually, which we'll come back to. It was a good learning experience, my sub-3, because I learned that actually you can stop during a marathon, and it won't harm your goals.
Yeah.
If you think by stopping and stretching, which is what I did, will actually benefit you and outweigh the kind of, I don't know, I must have stopped for maybe 45 seconds, maybe yeah. 20 seconds each time to stretch my hamstrings.
But if you hadn't, you might have had to stop.
I think I
for
just would have
time.
Been yeah. gradually slowing and slowing and would have probably just ground to a halt and missed the PB. So actually, it was a calculated risk to stop, but it paid yeah. off.
I think I had something similar. I think I stopped 2 or 3 times on Milton Keynes, the home of the marathon. And as long as you don't throw in the towel, you can still kind of pull off, you know, a good marathon time, I think. It's just like walking feels like a defeat in a marathon, but it doesn't necessarily have to be, as long as you can get going again.
I thought of another major mistake we've probably all made in marathons, which is to do marathons before super shoes existed.
Yeah, you're right.
Yeah. I'll finish on us.
Yeah. I have to go back and redo all of my marathons with better shoes.
I've kind of edited mine down a bit, like, no, it's more like that now. Yeah. Well, let's get into the list. So number one on the list. So we've divided this between training and race day itself. So 5 tips for training and 5 tips for race day. So number one is not practicing your fueling strategy enough in training. Kate, is that something you've done? What would you say on that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's really important, because there's sort of several things. Is like on race day, you're obviously putting your body through more stress. So it's quite hard to completely replicate that on a training run. But there are ways that you can get a little bit closer. So say you're doing, you practice your gel strategy. You think you've got your gels nailed. These ones seem to work well with your stomach. But you've only ever done it on like super like easy long runs where you're running for time, say. But then you might be have a run in your program that's like got bits of the run at marathon pace. So that's when you need to like test to see what your stomach does at that pace.
Yeah, right.
See if you can physically open these packets at that pace, which is not always easy.
Yeah.
Try it under a bit more stress, yeah. as well as just sort of, yeah, okay, this seems fine.
Yeah, I think that's a good point, actually. Almost like, yeah, doing it on kind of the higher speed sessions rather than just a very easy long run.
Mm. It's quite hard. I think testing your kind of gel strategy is doable, on your long runs. I found it quite hard to test my hydration strategy.
Okay, yeah.
And actually didn't. I mean, I used to do my long runs for the sub three. I was just doing them without water, which you kind of wouldn't really advise, but it was just the most practical way for me to do them, rather than run with a bladder pack or stash water bottles or do a loops round. So it was actually quite hard to test my hydration strategy, but I think testing your fueling is probably more important for sure.
Yeah, no, that's true actually. Even just things like knowing what's on the course. And also, like, two ways. A, is it cups and ball bottles, which, you know, maybe just practice drinking from. But B, like, if they're giving out gels on the course, if it turns out, oh, well, that's lucky, they're doing the ones I take, brilliant, you don't have to carry anything. I mean, people take sort of 8 gels with them. Like, it's not an insubstantial weight.
Yeah, yeah.
If you can just not carry that, then why not?
Yeah, I agree. I went through a phase where it was like a badge of honour not eating anything on the long run, which was a shame, because when it came to the actual marathon, I was like, all right, I need to try and have something every half an hour here. And it was just too much of a shocker for my stomach, I think, to be like...
Yeah, because you hadn't sort of trained your stomach. That's
the thing.
Yeah. I almost feel like you should sort of slightly ramp up to it. So, like, yeah, sure, you can do probably a 2-hour run in training with no gels, but what's it actually going to achieve?
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Because your feet, I mean, I remember someone saying to me once, I forget who, you're fueling the recovery as well as the effort. Mm. So if you're thinking of always with your training, you're thinking about the recovery so that you can do the next effort, then you've got to maximise that as well. So like I'd always get to the sort of towards the end, you know, if you're sort of taking it every X minutes, you get towards the end of a long run, well, that's not really much point taking it now because I've only got 25 minutes left and it kind of takes 20 minutes to hit the system and stuff and blah, blah, blah. But actually, that's still helping you recover as well.
Yeah.
That's a good point. Yeah. It's about the recovery, for sure. Yeah.
Right, number two is not trusting the taper.
Yeah, I mean, this is a classic one. I think the kind of, if your training's gone well and you get to that last 2 or 3 week kind of window, you feel very fit and you kind of want to stop running and you feel kind of antsy and itchy. And there's a temptation to want to prove your fitness as a kind of confidence boost. So, but ultimately, in the last week or two, it's not having any, you know, doing runs aren't really benefiting your fitness for the race. I remember I actually bumped into a guy at Expo once, and I'd bumped into him on a long run, and he was doing everything right. And then I bumped into him at Expo like 3 days before the marathon, and I was like, yeah, how's it going? You know, are you feeling good? And he told me that he'd done an 8-mile run. This was like Thursday before. An 8-mile run that day and an 8-mile run the day before. And I was like, well, what does your schedule say? Thinking, who's devised this schedule? And
he was Dean like, Cornelis.
Oh, no, it was like, yeah. He was like, oh, no, it's not on the schedule. I'm just feeling good. So I'm just like, I kind of internally, you know, rather than kind of upset him, but internally I was like slapping my forehead. What are you doing? We're running 16 miles during race week. So, yeah, I think... don't try and prove anything to yourself in that last week. It's all about the kind of resting.
And yeah. And also, I mean, I don't know about you, but like sometimes you, this when the taper starts to kick in, at first I actually feel rubbish. I feel really kind of sluggish and like, because my body's like, no, but I'm used to doing this. Why am I not doing this? Why am I not running more today? And then you start to feel like that antsy thing. So at that point you're like, but I feel, maybe this is a bad idea. I guess also like you were saying about the schedule, just like the plan, you know, you're hopefully following a really good plan, probably one devised by Run as well, I'm
hopefully,
sure.
Hopefully.
And that might well have like a bit of a little, almost like a kind of fast twitch test sort of a week or so before. So I think it's quite common, for example, Tom Craggs would often suggest a 5K sort of park run or something that's like 8 days before. And you can run that at your 5K pace, because ultimately it is, when you've been training for a marathon, it is only 5K. So in the context of that training, it's not a big load for your body. It can get your legs turning over nice and quick. And that can be a little confidence boost, even though it's not really meaningful, because it's perfectly possible to get a 5K PB and then not get a good marathon and vice versa. But that can, if you need to do something like that, then like 8 days before is okay.
That's interesting. I've got a little expert tip from Tom Craggs, actually. He says, reduce your running volume, but keep up the frequency, which is, I guess, what you're saying. So if you're running 3 to 4 times a week in a normal training week, continue with this, the same. The only thing that changes is the time or length of your run. So cut it by 30% in the final 2 weeks before your race day and 50% in race weeks. Yeah, so the idea of keeping the frequency and intensity, I think, is maybe something some people don't think about.
Yeah.
And actually, you can kind of keep it up, but it has to be a lot shorter in volume.
Yeah.
I think you said the next one, Kate, lack of consistency in training.
Yeah, I mean, I think basically, fundamentally, when it comes down to it, if you want to get better at running, the single most important thing that you can do is just be consistent in your running. You know, just commit to whatever it is you want to do, three runs a week, 4 runs a week, 5, you know, whatever it is. If you just keep doing that for your, whatever it is, 16-week marathon training plan, you will see results. And it's not very glamorous and it's not like some kind of, you know, internet hack, but it's just true, you know, and you can't kind of, it doesn't work if you try to sort of cluster it like, well, I haven't done anything for 2 weeks and now I'll do 2 weeks worth of the schedule this weekend, you know.
What do you think gets in the way of consistency? What do you think the enemy of consistency is?
Well, I think life gets in the way, doesn't it? We've all got, you know, busy lives and families and, you know, this time of year, everyone's got winter bugs left, right and centre. Yeah, yeah. You know, it's, a lot of these things are not in your control. So obviously, this is an ideal world scenario. But if you're looking at it thinking, oh, but I suppose also there's a lot of marathon training plans where it's kind of boring in that it just says, oh, 50 minutes easy.
Yeah.
Everything like all these kind of bread and butter runs. And you're like, well, I don't really get what the point of that is. Mm. I could just skip that. But it's about consistency. It's about building the base. And that is what will, you know, make the biggest difference, really.
I know what you mean. So those kind of unglamorous everyday runs that actually make a difference, which is harder sell than maybe like bashing out an interval session and feeling like you're fit.
Yeah, I mean, as Kate says, it's not an exciting concept, is it? It's not it's not the instant results that people demand these days. But yeah, absolutely. If you just keep ticking off the runs as much as possible, if you can get 95% of your schedule complete, you're on the road to success.
All right. Number four, not doing enough strength and conditioning. I think it's an area that runners struggle with a little bit, maybe from a not quite knowing what they should do, how much they should do. What do you think, Kate? Do you think that's
and also I think not seeing like the results of doing strength and conditioning are not really very visible, are they? I mean, like, well, I mean, if you get a great six pack, I suppose you do loads of it, but like the point of it for a runner is mostly to avoid injury and to help your form.
Yeah.
And those are not necessarily things, you know, avoiding an injury is
you don't
not
get
something
on Love
you
Island
can be.
From that.
And you don't go, yay, I've avoided injury for another 2 weeks. You just curse when you get one, you know. It's hard. But it is so important.
Mm.
Just kind of, you know, just for those two reasons, really.
Yeah. Yeah, we had Richard Blagrove came on the podcast recently, and he's very good because he's like the head of strength and conditioning at Loughborough University. So he knows what he's talking about. But he's also like acknowledges that runners have limited time and they need to be told some kind of general truths about strength and conditioning. So he was like, 7 moves that you should do twice a week, like with weight. And he said a squat type movement, a hinge hip movement like a deadlift, a stepping movement like a step up, a lunge pattern such as a split squat, a calf raise, and 2 upper body movements like a push and a pull. And that's basically, that will get you 90%. Of what you need. A few plyometrics thrown in and you're there. So that actually was quite nice to hear, like, you could do this twice a week and you're going to get mainly everything that you need, rather than, I think there's a lot of stuff online where if you're thinking that you have to do something every single day.
Yeah. Although equally, the good thing about strength and conditioning, I guess, is unlike running, you can sort of split it up and it's still effective.
Yeah.
Like you sadly can't do an hour's run in 5-minute bursts throughout the day.
Yeah, yeah.
But if you did strength and conditioning that way, it'd sort of be as good.
Yeah, he said that.
So if you did do, I almost feel like sometimes I feel like I'd be better off doing it every single day and I
for like 15
for 5
minutes.
10 minutes than leaving it twice a week where I get to Sunday and I'm like, oh, I haven't done it twice, you know.
Okay.
Sort of easier that way.
Yeah.
I think people get put off by the idea of strength and conditioning because they think it needs to involve going to the gym or it needs a Smith machine or a squat rack when actually a lot of the or all of the moves you just described, you can do with body weight or, you know, with dumbbells.
Yeah.
Which is not a major kind of cost, or you don't need a lot of space. You could do that at home.
Yeah.
But I think it's just grooving. It's like a lot of things. It's grooving the habit. I have to admit, I wasn't brilliant at doing strength and conditioning. So this is a mistake that I kind of made.
Yeah.
But generally, in marathons are bodily battle.
Yeah.
I think, and it's generally that it's some part of your body that starts to give up on you rather than you're out of breath or you're not fit enough.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Absolutely, for the marathon, I think strength and conditioning is key.
Yeah. It's funny though, isn't it? Because like I think some people do maybe like self get away with doing less. So it's almost like some people don't maybe necessarily need to get lots stronger to do a marathon, where some people it's like, if they miss a session, they'll really know about it in the week. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, I always think that like I wasn't running a marathon at the time, but the fittest I've ever been really was, depressingly, in lockdown when my gym did sort of like they started really quickly did a Zoom classes and they had like five a day, and I was like homeschooling, so my way of coping with this staying sane was I basically did all the classes all the time.
Right.
And I got so, like I did so much. It was all body weight.
Yeah.
I mean, we do have some kettlebells in the garden, but like it was all body weight. And I just did so much of it. And my running was like the same as I've always done, really. I didn't do anything different there.
Yeah.
But I was just so much faster. And I think it was like almost, you forget that there's like leg strength is a thing that actually, like I always notice it more now when I'm running, that you kind of get to a point in a run where it's you're not out of breath. You're not injured at all, but your legs just are like, they just start
just
feeling, just feel like they've suddenly got, a couple of kilos heavier each time you step, you know? And that is just like muscular strength you can build, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right. I think, it's an easy thing to, because you can think of marathon. Why do I need to get strong to run a marathon? That seems like they feel like very different things, don't they? But number five, trying to make up time lost to injury. So sort of cramming in training when you've been injured. What do you think about that, Andy?
Well, I suppose it's a natural enough instinct to try, and if you've got a schedule and you've missed a few sessions, to try and feel like you're fitting them all in for your kind of confidence.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's a false economy, because that way you're gonna if you're putting too many quality sessions together, or you're just running too much and you're not recovering properly, that's the way you're gonna get.
Re-injured.
Or just feel burnt out and overtrained. Mm. So, I think you've just got to be sensible. And I mean, the old hoary cliche of listening to your body, not trying to force it, for sure.
I think people also do make the mistake, like particularly if you're training through winter for a marathon and you know all the bugs and stuff around, is it say you miss, I don't know, 5 days or something because you've got some seasonal flu type bug. And I think people then think, oh, well, that's not an injury, obviously. So I can just smash it when I feel better because my legs are fine. You know, I haven't hurt myself in any way. I just had to rest for that. But it's exactly the same thing. You're just going to end up injuring yourself because you're just going from this sort of 100, 100 again.
Yeah.
And of course, your body is probably still recovering anyway from if you've been poorly enough to require 5 days off running, then you're poorly enough to take it easy when you come back, you know?
Yeah, and fitness doesn't go immediately, does it? I can't remember exactly what the timeline is, but I think you can go for about 2 weeks with basically no, it's going to make no difference.
Yeah.
I think it's 2 weeks, the stuff on info and detraining, isn't it?
Yeah. But also, I think there's the general rule of thumb, like if you're following a training program, if you miss less than or up to a week, you can just, with the proviso you should listen to your body, that you can just sort of pick up where you would have been. So you can skip that training, but pick up. If it's 2 weeks, you should go back a week. So like don't go 2 weeks ahead, go 1 week maybe. Yeah. And if it's more than that, then you should go significantly back, because if it's 3 weeks, you are going to have detrained a little bit.
Yeah.
Plus, you know, you're just kind of going to, your legs going to feel it. The muscles aren't going to be used to it as much. So then you just at that point have to recalibrate realistically what your expectations are.
Yeah, I think so.
This is the Runner's World podcast.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much. But when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, look, onto the race now. Number six.
What's race day?
The classic. Going out too fast. Going out too fast. We've all done that, haven't we?
No.
It's so hard not
to. You know, statistically, it's men who do this.
Oh, sorry. No, yeah. Sorry, no. Yeah, sorry, Kate. You're right. It's exciting, isn't it, when you kind of first few miles of a marathon. You should hopefully be feeling good, yeah, if you've kind of trusted the paper.
I felt great. Well, I should hope so. Yeah, yeah. It's mile two of a marathon.
It's always a kind of lament on Twitter. It's like, oh, I was on pace until 18 miles. And it's like, that doesn't...
Yeah, that's just bad yeah, pacing.
Yeah, that wasn't your pace then.
Going out too fast. So, Andy, you must have gone out too fast at some point.
Do you know, I think I was quite...
You're quite good.
In my marathon running career, I think I've been quite disciplined because I've always had a pace plan.
Yeah.
You know, this is what I want to be hitting mile one in. And I've been quite disciplined with that. But, you know, for sure, I think of all of the mistakes we're going through today, I think this would be the most common. You know, because it's, for all the things you've mentioned, it's the start of the race. You feel super rested and you're excited. You know, it feels great, yeah, and you just want to, you feel like you should be making hay while the sun shines.
Yes.
So like, I could take
bank
what
some
if,
time.
Yeah, what if I run 30 seconds per mile faster?
Yeah.
I'll be ahead of my pace, and you don't realize that, you know, especially if it's your first marathon, you don't realize that that's just, it's a ticking time bomb for the last few miles of overreaching. I know it seems like the end seems like quite a distance away. You're not really thinking that far ahead at that stage, but really you should be. But I always got around it by just having my mile splits on a pace band on my wrist and was very disciplined about, you know, 10 or 15 seconds, not a big problem, but 30 seconds to a minute.
Yeah.
You know, that's clearly too fast.
It's much, always taught so much about how important it is to run on feel, and it is massively important to run on feel. But the probable exception to that is like the first, I don't know, 5 miles of a marathon. Don't run on feel.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Run on pace, and like check you are actually running at the pace that you, because it will feel easy.
Yeah, of course.
I mean, some of them, like, you know, you've got London Marathon, you've got the sort of Shooter's Hill where you're going downhill at mile three or whatever.
Yeah.
And I mean, yes, sure, you can run that mile 10, 15 seconds faster, and that's fine. That's going to do any serious damage. But even more than that, even downhill, it's the impact. It's still hitting the ground, you know.
Another study on this found that running the first 5 kilometre segment of your marathon 10% faster than race pace adds about 37 minutes to the average finish time.
Wow.
Starting 10% slower adds about 29 minutes. You don't want to start too slow either. Most PBs came from running your first 5K at goal race pace.
I think the other way to avoid going off too fast, which is definitely pioneering, is just get older. I wish I could go off too fast.
Yeah. Look, you almost touched on this one, Andy, about mile splits on your wrist, but I think it's one that Kate suggested, trusting your GPS rather than the mile markers. That's a mistake. Yeah. Can you explain why?
Well, because a course is not measured according to GPS. A course is measured by, you know, professionals who, I mean, you know, have...
wheel.
Well, usually they have a bike wheel, essentially, yeah. not the one that you have to push. That would be cruel to make somebody 26 miles. Could you do that again? Yeah. Just check again.
You start you off, yeah.
Yeah. But it's, you know, they are very accurately measured. Of course, there are always these stories that come up when there's occasional...
Yeah.
But even those, when there's a race that turns out to be short, it's usually because somebody didn't follow the plan, not because the plan was wrong. Okay. Like somebody, a marshal may have inadvertently moved a cone at a turning point or something like that. It's not that the race was measured wrong. It's just, you know, implementation. So it's not, you shouldn't trust your GPS, particularly in city races, because it will go haywire. You know, if you've run London Marathon, you'll know, you know, you could get anywhere from sort of 24 to 28 miles on your GPS. Canary Wharf, it goes completely haywire.
Yeah.
When you go under Blackfriars Tunnel towards the end, you're obviously, well, you're in a tunnel. Of course, you're not going to have GPS signal. So all these things are going to completely get your watch pace out of whack.
Mm.
So that's why you have to, you know, look at the mile markers, if you prefer kilometres, kilometre markers, depending on where you are, and look at your watch, and then that's what you run to.
Yeah.
Ignore the rest. Turn off, I would say to people, turn off auto lap. Well, you know, Garmin, I think they default, don't they, to kind of auto lapping after a mile.
Yeah. Yeah.
That is not helpful in any race, really.
Yeah.
Because your Garmin will be clicking off the miles before you get to the mile marker.
Yes.
In the race. And
And of course, the other thing is you probably will run slightly more than 26.2 because there's like 30,000 people trying to run the same course. You can't all run the blue line.
It's something in London. Like, I think to run under three in London, you probably have to run 6:45 minute mile and not 6:52. Do you know what I mean? It's almost so it's actually quite an adjustment for people to be like, you actually have to run a little bit further than you might want to.
I remember way back, we did a feature on the Hugh Jones, who won the London Marathon in the 80s, I think, and then became the official course measurer. And he used to cycle the course with, I think, coincidentally, the machine is called the Jones machine or Jones wheel.
Yeah.
So he has to cycle the course and it clicks round. So it's very accurately measured. And I remember speaking to him for this feature, and I was a bit more of a novice then. And I was like, "Well, can't you just drive around the course and use a GPS?" And he just like laughed in my face, and then went, "Oh dear." And then it went on to explain in great detail how GPS is basically an estimation; it's not actually that accurate.
Yeah.
You know, especially around tall buildings and shade and cover. So yeah, I mean that's what, to reinforce the point that GPS, just think GPS is an estimate distance. It's not the distance.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Yeah.
I think if you're, I mean, one, I think one tip again, I think this comes from Tom Craggs, if you're going to keep looking for the mile markers, and you that's almost quite stressful.
Yeah.
Because it's something you're kind of worrying about. And then you've got a race band with 26 numbers and it's quite, my eyesight's not good enough.
Yeah.
So what I did for a couple of races was do 5K splits. Mm. And even if the race is measured in miles, there's pretty much always, you know, the timing chips that you run over, the big archways overhead are usually 5, 10, 15, 20, etc. So they're very hard to miss.
Yeah.
So at that point, you can check in, okay, 5K, yep, I'm on pace or, you know, near enough. And then it's a little bit less stressful than kind of obsessing over every mile marker.
Yeah. That's good. Number 8, this is good as well. Trying something new on race day. I once ran London Marathon in a pair of shoes I'd only run once in. It was an expo purchase. And I was working in running at this point.
Wow.
So like you're telling people, and I was like, I'm making the mistake that I've been telling people not to do for years. I think I can't remember exactly how this happened, but anyway, I ran really badly. It wasn't really the shoe's fault, but it was such a stress because I was like, after about 5 miles in his shoes, this is like, I've got no idea what they're going to be like on my feet. So I've got sympathy for people who try something new on race day, but it is a really bad idea to confirm.
Yes, everything. Nothing should be. You should have tested everything.
Yeah.
Your kit,
breakfast,
your clothes, your sunglasses, your, you know, absolutely everything. Yeah. Even like how you're going to carry, if you're going to carry like 8 gels, go for a run with your 8 gels, even if it's 5K or ran the block. Because if you've got one of those belts that you put gels in, but you've never actually tried running with that many, and then as soon as you do it,
the
belt's gone everywhere and there's gels flying. And So just sort of practice all of that.
Yeah, I think that's that's true. It's not just shoes. It's not just kit. It's food, all that stuff. Number nine, underfueling, easy to do. We've got Rena McGregor, who writes a nutrition column for Run as well. She says aim for 30 to 60 grams of carbs per hour for the first 3 hours of your marathon and increase that to 60 to 90 per hour after that. And you can get them that carbohydrates from sports drinks, jelly babies, gels, real food, all that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that sounds about right. 30 to 60, that's kind of 2 to 3 gels an hour.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that's about right.
Which is quite a lot, as Kate says. You, to do it properly, you probably will be starting a marathon with 8 gels.
A rucksack.
So I think it's something people tend to underestimate how much carbs you need.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess that's the ideal, isn't it? Like for optimum sort of performance. But the trouble is, of course, most of things do happen on race day. And yeah, you can have practiced it all you like, but actually tolerating that amount of gel when you're thrown in the adrenaline and the stress and everything, it is hard. So I think, you know, if you don't think you can handle that, then it's probably still better to do 2/3 of that or whatever.
Totally. Yeah. I remember Steve Way, who was kind of like, he was like the everyman who became like a kind of great runner.
He used to be a 40-day smoker and got to the Commonwealth Games.
Yeah, that's it. And his fueling strategy, which was gel-based, which was like that. He said, I know that I can't in the second half of a marathon take in any gels at all, so I just have 3 or 4 in the first half. Because I know I can take them in until then, and then I have nothing. And I just hope that's going to be all right. And that's what kind of
I mean, if you have to do that because that's the only thing that works for you, then that's what you have to do. You have to work with what you can tolerate, don't you?
Yeah, and I guess like doing it in training is how you work that out.
Yeah. I have once run a marathon with no gels. Wouldn't recommend it.
Nah.
We should also add to that underhydrating.
Mm. Yes.
Because I think it's, and I'm certainly guilty of not just not drinking enough water during a race. You know, I'll pick up a bottle at, sometimes I might miss a table because it's too crowded or I just didn't see it in time.
Have you got the technique?
I've definitely got a good paper cup technique going on. But I think it's, and because you're running fast and, you know, ideally running fast, I think you just overlook it.
Yeah.
And particularly, I think in the first half, you're probably not, because you're not starting to feel thirsty.
And especially if it's cold as well, I think you think about, you always think about it, I've got to stay hydrated if it's hot or warm. But if it's cold, you're still getting dehydrated. It's just not
as obvious.
As obvious. Yeah. But I think, I think a little bit often is probably the best strategy.
Yeah. I mean, think that you don't want to be kind of guzzling down a... I mean, they only serve it in 250 milliliter bottles, don't they? So it's hard to kind of overdo it, really. But pick up something at every opportunity.
Yes,
if it's every mile.
Just have a few gulps mouthfuls or whatever. Although I think it's more because it's more dangerous to overhydrate, isn't it, than to underhydrate. Underhydration, generally speaking, is going to compromise your performance, but probably not risk your health. Whereas
hypernatremia.
That's the one, yeah. I mean, that's really dangerous. Yeah. Obviously, that's pretty extreme. But in hot conditions, people do really, really perhaps over-worry about litres and litres of water.
Yeah, I think particularly before the race, you don't want to be kind of quaffing a 2-litre bottle in one.
Oh, God, no.
You know, an hour before
the start. Still in the luke when the starting.
All right, number 10, clinging to a time goal, even if training has gone worse than expected. I think I've done that. When you sort of set your hopes on like a kind of watermark time and maybe you lie to yourself that actually you can still do it, pull it out of the bag on race day, even though your training suggested otherwise.
Yeah, I would say that when we were, you know, we've had a Runner's World stall at Expo when we were running the pacing program.
Yes, yeah.
And I would say the most common inquiry that we had from people coming up who obviously had race places, they would say, well, when I was asked for my estimated time, it was 4 hours. Training went all right, but I had a holiday and then I got injured. Do you think it's still realistic to start in the 4-hour pen and go for that? And I would always say, probably not. You know, you need to, and that's quite a difficult skill, is to knowing when to recalibrate your goal.
And
also how much to recalibrate it for.
You
probably wouldn't be able to do it the first time you run a marathon because you need the experience, don't you?
To know what it's going to feel like.
But I think just thinking that once you start off with a goal and training's gone all right, but not brilliantly,
yeah,
to think that you can still have a go at it and the marathon will find you out, won't it?
Yeah. There's not a lot of places to hide in 26 miles.
Yeah. It'd also be a stress, wouldn't it? If you were kind of too high up, and most people presumably are running that pace, and you're struggling early on, I think it's
demoralising.
It's demoralising, and it's
if
a very long
like
day.
Everybody's going past you.
So I wanted to do three sort of more curveball ones here. Just as like little bonus ones here. So I'll start with one. We've talked about going off too fast, but I think there is a shout in a marathon for, I think it's called the positive fade. So this is going ever so slightly faster in the first half. So like say in a marathon, you might put a minute to 90 seconds in the bag.
Yeah.
Just with the idea that actually you may fade a little bit in the second half, but it's a kind of controlled fade.
Yeah.
It's a controlled fade as opposed to just blowing up. And I think actually stats would support that is the way to run your best marathon. It's probably going to be an ever so slight positive split. So not just about even pacing.
It's probably, and even though that's a slight fade in pace, it's probably still like that you're still putting more and more effort in.
For sure.
The second half is still, even if it's 90 seconds slower, probably way more work than the first half.
Yeah.
So, yeah, if you're thinking about effort-wise.
Yeah, I just think giving yourself something to kind of defend in the latter part when you're like, I've still got a few, like, you know, when you started to walk, and I walked in my best marathon as well, and I thought, but I've still got a minute here, you know.
Yeah.
If I was right on the line, I'd be like, now I need to go and catch up time. Whereas actually, I was like,
I've done it
unless
that
I
way.
Throw in the towel here, I'm actually going to do it. It's just not going to be very elegant and pretty, you know.
Yeah. So yeah, I think there's agree something different. 100%. That's how I did my sub three. I went through halfway in 1:28:30. So at 1.5 minute, I think maybe 2 minute kind of bank.
Yeah.
And that's what I ate into when I was stopping in the second half. Yeah. So I absolutely wouldn't have done it if I hadn't gone through halfway.
Yeah.
Slightly up on.
I think the same, pace. Actually. I did the same. I didn't stop, but I definitely slowed and then realised that Well, that's why my 5K strategy, like looking at your splits every 5K, slightly fell down when I got to 35K, no, 40K, and realised I was down.
Oh, really?
2K okay. to make it up. So, yeah.
Fair play for doing it, yeah. Okay, what's your slightly more surprising tip?
Mine's very, very generalist. Everybody will need to know this. If you are running in fancy dress and you're running in a giant panda costume, think about where you're going to put your gels, because panda costumes don't come with pockets.
That is good, though. If you've got, because obviously there's a huge fancy dress element to these races. So maybe you need to think about, you know, breathability.
Yeah.
Next time you need to do it as a kangaroo, because then you'll have a pouch.
True.
Oh, that's perfect.
True.
Yeah.
And also, like,
you have to hop as well, though.
My cadence would be terrible, though, because it would be like 3 per mile.
Super shoes would help, though, I think. Yeah,
that little boingy spring. Yeah.
Perfect. I'm surprised one of them isn't called the kangaroo, actually. The Nike kangaroo.
Watch this space.
Andy, what's yours?
Well, we mentioned not doing anything new on race day. Mine's just about not going mad at Expo.
Yeah.
Particularly the day before. I'll just walk around every stall and I'll get, well, what's that over there?
Eat all the freebies.
And also if you're doing like a foreign race in New York, say, oh, let's just pop down and see a few sights, and suddenly you're getting in at 6 o'clock and you've been on your feet for 10 hours the day 40, before a marathon.
40,000 steps, yeah.
So it's just, just veg out the day before. I mean, obviously do a shakeout run in the morning if you want to, but the rest of the day should be at leisure.
Yeah.
And if you're with some, like, obviously it's, if you're going like all the way to New York, say, it's expensive, and maybe you've got your other half or whatever with you, try and think of like ways that you can do something that involves staying down. Yeah. So like bus tours.
Yeah.
Chicago, that my tip that I always, everyone says this, but you go to Chicago Marathon the day before, there's a boat tour, an architecture boat tour, which is amazing.
Yeah.
And you're just sitting there watching lovely things go past and you don't have to move.
That's ideal.
So yeah.
That's perfect, yeah. I'd be interested to know what listeners have got to say. I'm sure they've got their own mistakes they've made. So if you've got any suggestions, it's podcast@runnersworld.co.uk. That brings the end of this week's Runners World podcast. Big thanks to Andy and Kate for joining us, and to you, of course, for listening. Goodbye.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.